Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR Connectivity, episode 338. I'm your host, John Reardon, and I am joined, as usual, by Neil Ronahan.
Hi. I could see that you almost were like, wait, what number is it?
I was mostly ready. I sometimes forget that I can just glance up at the URL for the Zencaster and and see exactly what the number is.
That was tough the week that you were out, that I didn't know. I had to go to the website to be like, what was the last episode? Crap.
But we're going to talk about games this week, because we've been playing a lot of them. We've been playing new games. We've been playing old games. We've been playing new games that look like old games. We've been looking at games that came out a couple years ago that are now looking significantly newer than they used
I didn't realize there was a theme with two of the games.
There is, yeah. But yeah, we've got a bit. We're going to start with, honestly, the game on this list of games that I am most excited about, and that's, Neil, you've been playing Shovel Knight Dig.
I have been, but before we get there, I did want to call out, I just glanced to see like what news happened, and all I want to say is Suikoden 1 and 2 are coming to Switch in 2023, which is just fantastic. I have nothing more to add other than I would like to play Suikoden 1 and 2 on the Switch, and I really like what they're doing. It's from Konami, and they are updating it visually, and I think there's some other like boost that they're doing as well. But it's a like a remaster of an old RPG that is not being done in HD 2D, which
right,
it looks great because it is just more expanding the original art as opposed to we put some lighting on the original art.
Yeah, well, I noticed that with Jordan posted his review of whatever Trails game that was.
Trails from Zero, I think.
Yes, yeah. And I had that thought of like, boy, I love RPGs with 2D characters in 3D environments. Like that is just, it looks great. Unless yeah. It's HD 2D, in which case it all looks identical. It is funny to because, each like, other.
It's more that I want the variety. It's not even that I think the HD 2D games look terrible.
No.
It's just that it's I feel like I could draw the comparison how like Marvel movies, like I was a little bummed out when it was like, oh, like Marvel is making all of the Marvel movies now, like Fox doesn't have the rights to X-Men anymore, because it was like, man, we're just gonna get the same type of movie over and over again, where right. Even if a lot of the X-Men movies were bad, occasionally they would be good, and it would be good in a way that Marvel, like the MCU apparatus, would never be good in that way. Like Logan cannot really exist in the MCU. Deadpool, only because of the success of Deadpool 1 and 2, will Deadpool exist in any capacity as he was in those first two movies in the MCU. And that's kind of how I feel like if everything's HD 2D, then we lose out on like the idea of the pixel remasters or what they're doing with Suikoden. Mm-hmm. And there are some unfortunate things that we get whatever the hell they're doing with Tactics Ogre, that as much as I'm excited for that game, that might not visually look great.
Yeah. My thing with it, like, I mean, I think like HD2D, yeah, it looked nice once because in that one instance, in the case of Octopath Traveler, it was like an intentional artistic choice.
Yeah.
Now that's just the Bible.
Yep.
For the games, with the exception of Octopath Traveler 2. The other games that have come out in HD 2D just look that way because that's what it looks like.
I'm curious to see how I feel about like Dragon Quest 3 when that version gets shown more yeah. And comes out.
Yeah, I'll bet it'll be brown.
It'll be very, very specifically lit.
Yes.
But Shovel Knight Dig is a game that, I mean, there's some brown in it, but it looks fantastic.
This was one that I got so distracted with Pocket Dungeon as like the Shovel Knight spinoff that Dig kind of snuck up on me. Like I was aware of it, but I guess it was one that I just hadn't seen much gameplay of, and then watched the trailer more recently and was like, oh, that looks more like Shovel Knight than I was expecting it to, but like 16-bit Shovel Knight.
Yeah, so I forget the exact timeline on it, but it's been a while since Dig and Pocket. Well, Dig was announced before Pocket Dungeon.
Yes.
I forget the exact timeline. You can Google it, but Shovel Knight Dig was announced, and it was it's being made with I don't know if it's Nitrome, but they did that game Bomb Chicken, that came out on Switch. Mm-hmm. Pretty solid game. And I think that that company has done a couple other things. And if you look at the art in Bomb Chicken and you look at Shovel Knight Dig, you can definitely see the similarities. But it's a lot more of like an arcade sensibility compared to Shovel Knight. But otherwise, it kind of just controls like a Shovel Knight game, but it's a, you know, roguelike design. And I think the comparison that really sticks to me, and it's something that I'm workshopping exactly how I'm going to write about it in my review, that will, at least the text at a minimum, will be up by the time you listen to this episode. Probably the video shortly after that, depending on when you listen. But it's like I thought about Ninja Gaiden a lot. Not necessarily the way it played, although, you know, 2D platformers. But Ninja Gaiden on NES is like this, like I think the visuals look great, but they are more, is distinctly 8-bit visuals, a little bit limited in that regard. And it's more of a cinematic presentation. Like the levels are maybe like a little bit more like action-y in a different way, whereas the arcade game is like big chunky sprites. You know, like a quarter munching game that's going to kick your ass a lot, although it's not like Ninja Gaiden NES didn't kick your ass, but it was in a different way. And just like Shovel Knight, the original game, like very challenging game, but Dig is difficult in a different way because of the fact that it is a roguelike or roguelite by design, where you are going through, you are digging into this cavern as Shovel Knight, and the levels procedurally generated. There's like different biomes and stuff. Generally, it seems like every biome has three standard levels and then a fourth boss fight. And that's the structure of the game, is when you go through these different levels, you die, you start back at the beginning, you retain some of the gems that you captured or found. And then you can use those to, you know, like buy some, it's typical of that style of game where you're like buying other items that you can find when you dive into the depths, or buying shortcuts to go to later worlds after you find them, of course. And there's some other things there's also like armor sets that you can get and things like that, things that would be very familiar if you've played yourself a Shovel Knight game. Across its, I mean, I guess there's, between all the DLC and Pocket Dungeon, Shovel Knight's a very robust catalog of games.
Right. Yeah, it feels weird to consider Shovel Knight a single game.
Yeah.
Because it's like at least four, right? How many?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then you have Showdown, which like that's kind of its own, I mean, once released is its own thing.
Yeah.
Like that was, they went hard with Showdown. Mm-hmm. But I've been liking Dig. I'm not gonna say like it's probably about what I expected overall. Like it is, I was a little wary of the roguelike formula, but it's been way more fun to just bomb around that world. And there was a game that you actually reviewed. I actually haven't looked at your review. Did you wind up positive or like mixed on Curse to Golf?
Oh, I'm pretty positive.
Okay,
I guess for that should be. So behind the scenes for anyone listening to this, it should be up by the time you're listening to this, but that review is written and literally just waiting on me to make a thumbnail for the video and that'll go up. But no, that one, I guess for anybody who didn't follow it, at launch, the Switch version had some bugs with like a capital B. It was impossible to progress beyond the first world.
Yeah.
So we gave it some time. And now having like kind of gone back in fresh after all that, that game is great. I wound up giving it an 8 out of 10, more because I don't think it doesn't do a great job of giving you a sense of progression, because that's something that I think a roguelike needs to do. Even though you're repeating over and over again, you need to feel like you're making it a little farther, and you can do that by making your character a little better every time. And Curse to Golf doesn't really do that. But other than that, I love it.
I think that's something that you hit the nail on the head of what works with Dig for me. Curse to Golf did feel, I mean, like I think the tutorial, it's a pretty beefy tutorial, and it does a thing that annoys me a little bit, where like your first run through, it limits aspects of the game, which I can kind of understand, and that right. Like the spin mechanic is maybe like a little complex. Like I definitely could see like you, if you're doing any kind of playtesting, I could understand people getting lost by that because it throws a lot at you. But that was what kind of got me to, and maybe I should go back now that I think they've done a couple patches to fix it up. But that was something that bugged me with it, is that I felt like the runs themselves took a long time, and it made like a loss, especially as you got to, you know, like a handful of holes in, crushing, because you're like, I just spent an hour on this. And I don't really feel like I'm approaching this in a way where like I'm like, oh, I figured this out. It feels right. Like it was just a lot of repeating the same actions, which Shovel Knight did by design. Like, you do repeat a lot of that, but what I think it does very well, and it does remind me of something like a Spelunky, and think ways that Spelunky succeeds definitely were taken to heart in Shovel Knight Dig, in that, like, there's that you learn the tricks of the world. So like each, like, for example, yeah. The first area, it's like a mushroom themed like dungeon area, and there's certain enemies. There's actually, it's really funny, and I got like totally caught off guard by this. But you know how like you, like, New Super Mario Brothers, how you could turn into Mini Mario?
Yeah.
You basically, if you get hit by, like, there's in the first area, there's kind of like a spore creature that if you get hit by it, you turn into Mini Shovel Knight. And I was very confused, because like as I'm playing the game, I'm like, how the hell do I get through this like small, like this Shovel Knight like slide, like Mega Man and Mega Man 3? That'd be pretty cool. And then, like, as I'm thinking that, I got hit by one of these spores and got turned into Mini Shovel Knight. I was like, what the hell? Because it does that thing, like, it makes me think of, oh, God, what's the Jet Boots game? Downwell.
Yeah.
Where you're going down, like, in Downwell. But a lot of the areas where you, like, can, like, go to a shop, it's usually just, like, a room off to the side of the dissension. So like that's you, like, sometimes you'll need a key to get to those, sometimes they'll just be there, and other times you need to be turned into Mini Shovel Knight to get there. But there's a lot of tricks like that throughout the different worlds. Like, there's like, I kind of almost don't want to get into too many specifics, but these are like some of the second areas, because it does that thing like in Dead Cells. I feel like I'm just referencing other roguelike games, so sorry if this is just a nesting doll that is very confusing to you.
Right. Well, hopefully, if you reference enough, then everyone will have played one of them.
Write in if you're like, what the hell did you mean? But it, like, so you go through, like, every time you go through, it's the same mushroom first world, but you might have an option after you go through that mushroom world to either go to a fire area or a water area. And that kind of, that the same thing happens as you progress. There's a variety of different biomes that you can go to. But without getting too deep in any kind of spoilers, the fire area and the water area are kind of the, you know, the second areas that you can go to. And in the fire area, there's fireballs being shot at you by different enemies. And there's a trick to learning how to deal with all of that. In the water area, it does something really cool where it kind of in line with how you're going downward, there will be like waterfalls that will be going through. And there's like fish enemy that follow these waterfalls or like spawn up the waterfalls. So you can kind of, as you hit different blocks, guide where this water goes. And it's like real, like you can just kind of play the game and not focus on it, but you can also do some really cool things by messing with the environment around you. And that's where I think this succeeds, in that like there's a lot of variety in each of the different areas that you go to. And part of succeeding in Shovel Knight Dig is learning the tricks of those areas. Like I died a lot in that first area, and now I'm at a point where if I'm playing through that first area, that's just basically like me barely taking damage and just accruing whatever I can to, like, you know, you get like different accessories and upgrades and stuff, like accruing whatever I can, so that way when I get to the next, like the second and third and so on biome, I'm in a really good spot to make a deeper run. And it is something that, like, as I'm playing more of the game, I'm learning that, like, that water area and that fire area, I'm not quite as dominant as I am in the first area, but I'm working on it. Like, you know, beating those bosses and stuff. And, you know, the more I face them, the more it's easier, because you start to learn the patterns of the bosses, or you're like, oh, this boss is going to be tough, but if I go in with this relic as a sub weapon, and I have this amount of health, and like, there's a lot of fun ways to mess with the game, to try to like set yourself up to, you know, make up for your deficiencies. And if you're playing Shovel Knight Dig and you're frustrated by it, bless Yacht Club Games for including a variety of modifiers where you can like increase the amount of health that you have, or I think like decrease the damage, slow the game speed. I love that that's in there. There's part of me that wants to kind of, you know, amp up, you know, how much health I have, so that way I can just like burn through and beat the game. But I also stubbornly want to reach the credits, reach the final boss on my own, because I've been enjoying the challenge of this game so far. And it does the thing that all the Shovel Knight games have done, where there's like an overworld to roam around, characters to talk to, you know, different feats to get. Like the Yacht Club is very good at this, and yes. And Shovel Knight Dig is proof that they have not lost their fastball. It's a very good game, and it just scratches a different itch than the baseline Shovel Knight. And it does really feel like I'm playing the arcade version. Maybe a different way that will be relevant to what we're going to talk about next. I feel like I'm playing like the Hyperstone heist to Shovel Knight's Turtles in Time. I feel like I'm playing the Genesis version to like a Super Nintendo version, but like they're completely different games for some reason.
Yes. Like it still feels like Shovel Knight, but it's not at all the same game. Yeah.
It is the kind of thing that like I've been thinking about, especially when Dig got a release date, of like, oh, I should romp through the first, like the original Shovel Knight. Shovel of Hope is the subtitle that they've given it now. Because I don't think I've played through Shovel Knight. Like I played through it multiple times around when it came out. I know I beat it on like 3 or 4 different systems.
Well, that's my problem with the original Shovel Knight, is every time I think about going back to it, I'm like, well, I own it on 3DS and Wii U. I should probably buy it on Switch just to have it on a platform that I'm actively playing.
Yeah, I think I have it. I own a physical version of it on 3DS, just because I thought that was where I first played it, was on 3DS. I love that game on 3DS. I did all Street Pass crap too, and I have it digitally on Wii U. I have it digitally on Switch, and I have at least the PlayStation version. I might even have the Xbox version.
Good.
Like, I love this damn game, and I guess full disclosure, I backed the original Kickstarter campaign at the cost of the game.
Go ahead and throw away everything you've said about Shovel Knight Dig, then, because it's all corrupted.
But yeah, like I should replay the first Shovel Knight, but I do think about how it might be the kind of thing where I go back to Dig when I have an urge to play Shovel Knight, just because of the fact that, hey, procedural levels, the way this game's designed, it's really cozy. And I'm loving it so far. I need to finish writing the review. I need to, you know, make more attempts to try to beat the game. But unless it like I get to the back half of the game and like all of a sudden they're just like making a lot of racist jokes and like the controls just terrible. This is going to be a positive review. But you'll have to either check NintendoReport.com or look at the website and be like, oh, what happened? He said he was going to have the review done by now.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'm doing well.
The reason we have this podcast is so that Neil will write the Shovel Knight Dig review and I will make a thumbnail for Cursed to Golf.
Yeah,
so
we're just trying to keep ourselves accountable.
Yep.
But yeah, I highly recommend it. It is, I don't know, my favorite game since Xenoblade 3. Which, brief update with that, I'm still in Chapter 5. I've avoided specific spoilers that I remember, and I know I'm getting very close to something that is probably going to rock my face off.
And, chapter and not, 5 is one of the chapters that trended on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah, I managed to avoid any specific spoilers, but I love that game. It's just that life and other games like Shovel Knight Dig have gotten in the way, and Splatoon.
Yeah, I saw a used copy of Splatoon today, and I looked at it and I was like, "Oh, it's used. I could get it." I didn't get it.
Yeah, I'm not shocked that there's used copies already.
Yep. You know what else you're probably only going to find used copies of? Not going to take a guess. All right, fine.
Is it Beyond Oasis?
I was just going to say Genesis games in general, but...
Fair.
Yeah.
I mean, technically, you can find a new digital copy of it on your Nintendo Switch if you are a subscriber to Nintendo Switch Online at the expansion pack level.
Yeah, so the most... what was it? Like a day after the Nintendo Direct?
Yeah, it is funny that, like, I saw some stuff... I mean, I could tell you why, but not to sound mean, who gives a shit?
Right. Oh, absolutely. But why not be like, here's a bunch of N64 games and GoldenEye, and in addition, today we're dropping these Genesis games. You don't have to make, like, it's not that Earthworm Jim needs to be your show ender, but like, you could have sprinkled this in so that something happened at the direct and it wasn't just here's the schedule. Like, but yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So the update was Earthworm Jim 1 is the.
Yes.
Because then 2 is on Super Nintendo.
So,
which...
And this is actually a cool. So Earthworm Jim 1 and 2 were on both Sega Genesis and Super Nintendo. Each of them were. We already have Earthworm Jim 2 on NSO, and it's the Super Nintendo version, which is the correct choice because that is the best version of Earthworm Jim 2. Earthworm Jim 1, we got the Genesis version of, which is the correct choice because that's the best version of Earthworm Jim 1. And so whoever is at Nintendo making the decisions for which versions of Earthworm Jim to use, just know that I see you and I appreciate you.
the other game, like, and that's the thing, is that like, I think you need to make the presentation as to why these games are important, but like, it was a good selection. I mean,
yeah,
you know, fuck anti-trans people. As far as related to Earthworm Jim, it's okay if you play the games, just accept that one of the big creatives is a big anti-trans dingus.
Yes, I mean, if it makes you feel
politically, also get. I just, you know, I like people,
yes.
And he doesn't.
Yes, and if it makes you feel any better about playing it. Every game you've ever played has probably been worked on by someone who you didn't like, if it helps.
But Alicia Dragoon, that was in a release, and that's a game arts game. The team who made, I think it's the people who made Grandia, I believe. I think this was okay. Like the game they made before Grandia. But it's like this weird, the art's really nice, and it's just this weird arcade game where it's like a 2D platformer that plays like a shoot 'em up. Bizarre stuff.
You have like your weapon is like this electrical attack that just hits everything. Like it ricochets between all of the things. It's weird. But also in that group was Beyond Oasis, which I had previously started but made no progress in on the Genesis collection on Switch, like the physical Genesis collection. And I didn't make it very far on that because it was one of the worst games in that collection as far as input latency went, and I just found it just impossible to play.
It is an action RPG, after all.
Yes. Brief
mention, Game Arts did make the Grandia games, but they made Alicia Dragoon right before they made the Lunar games.
Okay.
So that's its connection. And also, Alicia Dragoon has some ties to the to Gainax, I believe, which is a Japanese animation studio that dabbled with some video game stuff pretty briefly. Actually, Masato Kato worked at Gainax, I believe, my beloved Chrono Cross developer.
Interesting.
But that's what Alicia Dragoon. It's interesting. Beyond Oasis, yes. Actually good.
Yes, and I mean also, yeah, it is a Zelda-like. It is a Genesis game, and I don't know if this is the actual story. It feels like a Sega Genesis attempt to make a Zelda game on Genesis.
It's also a Yuzo Koshiro game. It's ancient, which is Yuzo Koshiro's company. For people who don't know, he's responsible for the friggin' radical music of ActRaiser, Streets of Rage, Etrian Odyssey, like legendary composer who also does he does have his own game development products like ActRaiser. ActRaiser is just in the music for. Quintet developed it, but Ancient has made, in addition, more recently, the Gata Protectors, which came out on Switch earlier this year. There was also a 3DS release of it.
Yeah, his credits are extensive. And I will say, the soundtrack in this game is great.
Koshiro does not miss, man.
No, and it's cool because like I've seen like there's plenty of Genesis and like Super Nintendo games that are like, I mean, Link to the Past, very orchestral. What this game does with its music that I think is really cool is that it's not afraid to mess with like the volume of the music. Like it'll go down really quiet so that it can like build insanely loud in a way that I've never heard another 16-bit game do, and it's great. But yeah, so I started this game because I was just like, I only played that in a horrible way. I want to actually see how this plays. casually started it up, played for probably around an hour and did like two dungeons and was like, man, I'm like really into this. I'm having a really good time. And especially with rewinds and save states, like I didn't use save states much, but rewinds essentially just to like, if I died, then rather than like going back to the checkpoint of like the beginning of the dungeon or whatever, just rewind back to the beginning of the room. So it just made it a bit more user friendly. But it feels like if you made it feels like Zelda made by someone who had a lot of experience in beat 'em ups. Because the combat, yes,
it's almost,
yes,
it's almost yes. like he made Streets of Rage.
Right. Yes, you caught that. Yeah, because you know, like Zelda, you just hit the guy, he goes back. In this, like you have like a three hit combo attack. You have special attacks. You can like hold down the button to kind of like charge a swipe. You do have like a spin attack like Zelda. If you can jump and then do an attack in the air and you kind of like kick down from the air, just like a beat 'em up, it is just beat 'em up combat in a Zelda game. And as a result, I think the combat is like way more interesting than Zelda of this same time period, which is good because the game relies a lot more on its combat. It does have puzzles, especially in the back half. It gets a lot more puzzle solvey, but there's way more combat and platforming, which is a choice in a top-down 2D game, but they it like usually works okay. There are a few times where it's like jump between these moving platforms over endless pits, and in those instances, thank God for rewind. But yeah, it was only about like 5 hours long, so I played, like I started over the weekend and finished it last night, Tuesday, and probably playing like an hour every night or so. It's the second game I finished that wasn't like Star Fox on NSO, the other one being Super Metroid. And I had a really good time with it. And I enjoy discovering, like, it's one thing, you know, there are games like Jelly Boy on NSO that you play and it's like, oh, this is a fun thing. This is interesting. And you're not going to finish it, but like, it's fun to try those things. It's very rare for me to like be able to pick up an old Sega Genesis game and just be like, what's this? And then just play through it and be like totally engaged with it. So yeah, this was a nice surprise. And the sprite work in it is just wonderful. They're these big, bulky sprites. I mean, like you were talking about with Shovel Knight Dig, it has that very like arcade quality sprite work where everything is just chunky, and really heavily stylized. It reminds me of the Genesis version of Aladdin. It has kind of that Disney look to it. And then at the beginning,
your main character is Ali. So
right,
like
he's very, you know.
I remember as a kid, like I didn't play this game until, I don't know, some Genesis collection, probably like 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I remember seeing it. I'm being like, they made an Aladdin video. Is that like related to the Genesis game in the movie? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like it does like that much like Aladdin.
Yes, especially, yeah, like the other characters in the game, not as much, but your main character, look, he is blonde Aladdin.
Yeah.
It also has weapon durability, just like Breath of the Wild.
Classic. So they stole it from it.
Yep. So just, you know, fair warning, Justin, if you're listening, I don't know if this one's for you. Maybe pass on this one. It's a little too much like Breath of the Wild. But yeah, no, it's really cool. There were only late in the game, there's a few instances where throughout the game you're picking up these like spirit things that you can summon with your arm guard.
As you
and,
do.
Yes, they're like different. There's like a fire one and a water one and a shadow one and a like grass one. And you summon them by like shooting this little orb at those elements in the environment. So you can only use them when you can find a way to summon them. So to summon the fire one, there has to be fire that you can hit with your arm thing. For water there, you have to find like a puddle or something. And the game does some really interesting stuff where like early on, it's like you summon the water one from a pool of water. It makes sense. There's one later on where you have to summon it from a reflection. And there are these crystals that you always summon it from. And late in the game, there's one where you need it, but there's no crystals anywhere. And the game does not tell you this. But if you shoot your arm thing at an armored enemy that's wearing like steel plated armor, you'll summon the reflection one. And I was like, that's really cool. I wish the game would have given me any hint that that was a mechanic that I could make use of, but it's really cool. And there's a lot of instances like that. Of like, once you figure that out of like, oh, okay, it's not that I need to summon it on these literal tiles that are water or fire or whatever. I need to actually think about, okay, in reality, is this thing reflective? Is this thing technically like, there's some spots where you'll have like some water drizzling down on the wall and you can summon the water one from those. So it's, it does some cool stuff with that. But these spirits also tend to have like sub mechanics that the game just doesn't tell you about. And so there is some trial and error. There was one puzzle right at the end where I did wind up just pulling up a walkthrough and then didn't feel bad about it at all, because the thing it wanted me to do, I did not know was a mechanic of the game. But other than that, very solid. Apparently there was a sequel on the Sega Saturn, so I may see if I can get that running on the Xbox Series X and give that a shot, especially if maybe it's only, you know, 5 hours long again.
Yeah, maybe I'll try to get that running on my Steam Deck when it arrives in like a week or so. Gearing up. Be prepared for hot Steam Deck impressions as I play Final Fantasy VII Remake on it and dabble with Waking Dreams.
Yes. Well, did you wind up buying the Steam version of Chrono Trigger?
Yes. Yes, I did, actually.
Okay. So, yeah, we'll be playing that then. Chrono Trigger and widescreen.
I have a wish list. Like, feel free, actually, if you want to write in to connectivity@nintendoreport.com with a brand new top of mind Steam games for me to add to my wish list to check out on my Steam Deck. I got Final Fantasy VII Remake and Chrono Trigger because they were on sale. I'll probably get one of the pixel remasters in a bid to try to jinx it and get them to come out on Switch. And yeah, I have a pretty deep wish, or an increasingly deep wish list, because as I think of games, I toss them on there. I know Windy Man Steven Rodriguez, former NWR director in the NWR Discord, mentioned a game called Hex Cells that I will probably get. Apparently it's a pretty good like Picross feeling game. I don't think it's quite like Picross, but it's just good puzzles. So I'm looking forward to diving into this. I've never been a serious PC gamer. I don't think the Steam Deck is going to completely change that, but I'm definitely going to be more liable to play a game on Steam than I ever have been in my entire life.
Yeah, it's fun to open up a new library.
Yeah.
Even if you're not going to engage with it really thoroughly. I did get to hold a Steam Deck the other day.
What'd you think?
It's large, but it's not as like thick as I thought it was going to be. It's only a little thicker than like a Switch. At least in the middle part, you know, the handles are large. I still don't like the button and like the button layout of having,
like, it's all at the top.
And it's in a line horizontally as opposed to vertically. That's still odd to me, but it seemed nice. It was nice. Yeah. Yeah. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on it.
I think because I was talking to hi Andy, I think he listens, but Andy Gergen, former co-host,
heard me talking about Dreamcast stuff the other week, so he must listen occasionally.
He got like his email at the end of August and then got it like pretty early in September, and I got my email, you know, earlier this week. I think it was Monday September 19th. So I haven't gotten any kind of shipping notification yet, but it seems like it's probably like a week and a half to 2 weeks after you'd like get the confirmation email that it should probably show up on my doorstep. So maybe next week I'll be talking about it, or it might be the week after.
Sweet. Yeah. Looking forward to it. But we were going to talk about, in addition to Beyond Oasis, we just kind of got talking about Genesis games. So we thought we would call out a few of the ones that we've been playing in case you, as a listener to this podcast, are very much in the Nintendo sphere of the console wars and maybe haven't played as many Genesis games.
Yeah, they're over like 30 games on the Nintendo Switch Online app. It's a pretty decent library, all things considered. And I think that they seem to be continually adding games. There's definitely a lot left on the table that seem reasonable to expect. I know for my money, I know Dynamite Heady is a game that I will always bring up. It was my first exposure to treasure developed games as a kid. This was like a game that my parents just like straight up like got me new when it came out. And it's an incredible platformer made by Treasure, who, you know, maybe more known recently for doing stuff like Radiant Silvergun, which was a shadow drop at the Direct, or Ikaruga, or Wario World. Sin and Punishment is another game that yeah. Treasure made. Gunstar Heroes, which is another great game, also on the Genesis NSO app.
Is Sin and Punishment on the N64 one.
Treasure, well represented, just crossing my fingers that Mischief Makers makes its way onto the N64 app. That would be a coup if Mischief Makers were to show up in any playable form in the modern era.
Who published that?
I believe Enix did.
Okay.
I think it might be a rights quagmire. And it's also probably the kind of thing that, like, even if, like, yeah, like Mischief Makers is the truth, it's very good. But it's definitely one of those things that I think that, you know, Treasure, I believe, is like one person, like, signing rights away and cashing a check every now and then. And I think anybody at Square Enix, like, this weirdo N64 game from 25 years ago is probably not at the top of the line for them to bring back. I feel like the Enix contingent isn't well represented, or else we would have seen a lot more like ActRaiser and other Quintet games. Although we did get ActRaiser Renaissance. We did. So hope springs eternal. But honestly, if I had to settle for Mischief Makers dying and I got to like play Terranigma again, I'd be fine with playing Terranigma.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Square Enix is their insane release schedule this year, all of a sudden.
They're running out of games to bring out. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's only a matter of time.
But yeah, Dynamite Hattie, super fun platformer. The main mechanic there is that your character named Hattie, he has a head that shoots out like a spring, and you can get different power-ups to change his head. Some of them are helpful. Some of them are real dumb. Like a bomb goes off or you fall asleep. It's basically like a weird take on Kirby, and the whole setup is like it's a theater thing and there's a fucking cat. It's weird. I love it. Great game. Jesse, what do you have from your list of Genesis games?
I've talked about it on here before, but I always got to bring it up. Shining Force 1 and 2 are both on the Genesis.
Yeah, app. 2 got added kind of recently, and I've been meaning to check that out because I've dabbled in the first one more recently. I want to say 2 is the Shining Force game that I beat a long, long time ago, but I don't totally remember which one is which, but I kind of want to revisit 2.
2 is definitely one where I feel like you can see the golden sun in Shining Force 2. They're made by what would eventually become Camelot.
Yeah, I don't think they were Camelot at this point, but it's the Takahashi brothers are there.
Yep, but there is a lot of, even just in like the visual style, there's a shift between Shining Force into Shining Force 2. And suddenly, like, you look at Shining Force 2, and that's, I believe, the game that introduced, like, the Camelot thing of doing, like, the emojis over people's heads during dialogue cutscenes. Like, that's from Shining Force 2. The first one had this, too, but the second one also has the, for selecting, like, yes or no on a question, it's the nodding head and the shaking the head.
Yeah.
Which is another, just every Camelot game does that. Yep. So it's really interesting from that perspective of just seeing like, oh, like this is like you can see the identity forming. But they're both great. They're tactical RPGs in the vein of Fire Emblem. But unlike the early Fire Emblem games, there are like, you know, towns that you wander around in between missions, and you like go to inns and like go to shops to buy gear and talk to people, and they're like little optional side characters you can find. So it almost in a weird way in some respects feels more like modern Fire Emblem, where there's more of a kind of exploration and like talking to people element between stages. But there's no permadeath. You are punished monetarily when people die. The more people you have to revive after each fight, the more it costs you, which I think is actually a really good alternative to permadeath, where it's like, no, they don't, like, you still want to keep them alive because it's very inconvenient for you if they die, but like, we're not going to kill them off forever.
Yeah,
but yeah, they're both really good games. great soundtracks. And I think especially compared to the Fire Emblem games of the era they came out in, A, Shining Force came out in America, and B, I think they just compare very favorably to early Fire Emblem.
The tragedy with Shining Force is that by the time Fire Emblem came out, Shining Force was long dead, or Fire Emblem came out in America. Because the story with that, I actually was curious for when Camelot became Camelot, and they started off like they were basically like a partner with Sega. Like mm-hmm. they were Sega Consumer Development Studio 4, and then changed the name to Sonic Software Planning, which was named after Sonic the Hedgehog. Mm-hmm. But then they separated in 1995 after making a bunch of, they basically just made Shining games. Because there's also Shining in the Darkness, which is like a first-person dungeon.
Technically the first one. Yeah. That one's, like a first-person dungeon crawling
It's RPG. Not great, at least for me.
It's not, it has some technical, like the whole like exploring kind of the 3D dungeon thing is neat, just given that it's from 1991. But other than that, there's not much to write home about.
They made a ton of Shining Force games. There's ones on Game Gear. Some got remade for Sega CD that is going to be coming in that the Genesis Mini 2, which I'm really excited for. I'll be real, playing Shining Force CD is one of the reasons why I have that thing pre-ordered.
Yeah, the Shining Force CD is also, it's one of, or maybe both of, the Game Gear games.
There's two Game Gear games remade. That are remade. And and then I forgot that they made Beyond the Beyond, which is a Sony-published RPG very early in the PlayStation. I've always been curious about that game, but I've never played it. It's kind of their first traditional RPG before Golden Sun. But then, 1998, they were making Shining Force 3, which was like this ambitious game split across multiple scenarios that were all different releases. Mm-hmm. In 1998, Sega was basically demanding that everybody focus on Dreamcast, and Camelot was like, F you, we want to finish our Shining Force games. And then that kind of led to a split where then Camelot started working with Nintendo. And since that day, it's been almost 25 years, and Camelot has made like, I don't know, something like 20 different games with Nintendo, largely Mario Golf and tennis games, occasionally a Golden Sun. And they made one golf game with Capcom on the Wii. But it is interesting to just see Camelot be a studio that started literally underneath Sega, and then at this point they've functionally been a part of Nintendo, or at least a partner with Nintendo, for like three times as long as they worked with Sega.
Well, in the Shining series, it kept going, but they stopped being good games at exactly the moment.
Yeah.
That Camelot stopped making them, like,
because there's a lot of them too.
Yes, well, in like Shining Force 3, only the first scenario came out in the US. The rest have never been localized, and the only good Shining game since Shining Force 3 was the remake of Shining Force on Game Boy Advance.
I do remember that being,
which
good.
Was great. But obviously that's because it was one of the old ones.
I did play, it got ported to Switch, Shining Resonance Refrain.
Oh, I tried.
I was playing terrible. That, and I'm like, how is this related at all?
Right.
And then that's when I kind of went down, because at first I was like, oh, cool. Like, I mean, honestly, like the Shining series had not been, there were a couple, but there was the remake of the original on Game Boy Advance and a couple like Game Boy era. I think there was one DS one. But it just wasn't, I think a lot of them didn't come over to America. So I played Shining Resonance Refrain being like, oh, cool. Like, I remember Shining Force. And then I'm like, what the hell is this?
Well, they keep trying to make them into action RPGs.
Yeah.
Like, that was like the first thing they did after Camelot left was they're like, all right, here's Shining Soul for the Game Boy Advance. It's a Diablo clone. And it's like, well, why? And they keep... They've done a few more tactics games since then that haven't been very good. But yeah, it's bizarre that they just don't seem to get it.
Instead of like, let's make our own Fire Emblem, they're like, let's make our crappy Tails variant.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, play Shining Force.
You know what's on my Steam wish list? Tales of Symphonia on PC. because I'm like, wait a minute, I don't need to wait for Switch. I can play this 30 frames per second on my Steam Deck.
Right. Probably easier to mod to 60 frames per second on your Steam Deck, too.
But a game that this was actually not the first time I ever played this game, because I do have a Genesis Mini. Mega Man the Wily Wars is on Genesis Nintendo Switch Online. And if you've never played this before and you have access to Nintendo Switch Online, I highly recommend it. Not because I think these are crappy versions of all of the Mega Man games.
Yes.
But they are fascinating.
It's arguably the first example of a HD remake, or one of the early examples of it.
Yeah. It was never officially released in America. It was only available through Sega Channel, which is also one of those things where it's like, oh, hey, like Sega was ahead of the times. Although Sega actually like brought that everywhere, as opposed to a lot of Nintendo's Satellaview was Japan only.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is the first three Mega Man games fully remade on Genesis. I played through Mega Man 2 with one of my friends that we played a lot of Mega Man games together over the years, and it was just like he's good at Mega Man. I'm okay. But like we just died so much because it was like just close enough, but then like some of the timing would just be a little bit different. Like some of the bosses were way harder because we just weren't used to the rhythm of it.
Well, even the movement it has. So like in Mega Man on NES, you click forward and you run forward. In Wily Wars, you click forward. Mega Man does this awkward single step, pauses for a moment, and then runs forward.
Yeah.
And it creates this feeling of like insane input latency, and it's horrible. It's terrible. Cause yeah, visually they look awesome. Like they're really well redone.
And it's fun hearing the music in the Genesis style.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
But there's also, if you do want to go through, I don't know if there's like a special version on Genesis MSO, maybe it'll come eventually. Because the real thing with Wily Wars is that if you beat Mega Man 1, 2, and 3 on it, then you unlock wholly new content in the Wily Tower, which I've heard about, but I've never actually played for myself because I've not beaten all three games on a copy of Wily Wars.
Right, because why would you?
Yeah, I've got better things to do, like Shovel Knight.
But it is a fascinating curiosity.
Just like Sonic Spinball.
I've been playing some Sonic. So the thing about Sonic Spinball, like Wily Wars, I think this is a great idea for a video game. I don't think that this video game is that great, though. Like Sonic Pinball, good. But this particular game is so like weirdly choppy. Like the frame rate is kind of bad. Like just like the scrolling around.
It's
the
a very
field.
Grungy game.
Yeah, and it feels like heavy and it controls kind of poorly. Because like essentially like you're Sonic as a pinball, and whenever you land somewhere flat, so like he's not rolling anymore, he just stands up and you can walk around as Sonic, which is a neat concept. But he controls like he was designed by somebody who's only seen like cave drawings of video games. he's so slow and clunky and unresponsive and just a horrible, like I've just failed at basic walking tasks in that game because Sonic controls so poorly. But it's such a great concept. Like the idea is really cool. The presentation is cool. And it's worth looking at because it's kind of a weird Sonic spinoff, but hoo boy, it has some issues. I do know people who love it.
I hope, and I think this is another one that's going to be on that Genesis Mini 2, which that's soon. That's next month.
Yeah.
I hope Sonic 3D Blast comes to this, because even if the Genesis version is janky as all get out, that's another game like Spinball where like I feel like the concept of it is kind of neat, but the execution, at least even from my memory, where I don't think I've played 3D Blast in like 20 years. I remember it always kind of being bad, but I remember being fascinated by it.
Are you familiar with Game Hut on YouTube?
No, I'm not.
It's a YouTube channel that's run by John Burton, who was a producer at Traveler's Tales and did a bunch of or a developer at Traveler's Tales and did a bunch of like the Lego games and stuff.
Yeah, but they made 3D Blast.
Yes, they did. and he was like instrumental in it.
Oh, he's and the so founder he has, of Traveler's Tales.
Yes. So he did a patch for the Genesis. I don't know if it's the Genesis. He did a patch for one of the versions of that
game. The Genesis version, an unofficial director's cut of
3D Blast. Yes, and just went in and was like, he's like, okay, I understand everything that's wrong with this game. Like, here's, like, we were limited by these things at the time. I'm going to fix it. And he's like, because essentially, like, I just think he felt like there were good ideas there.
Yeah, no, like, I think there are good ideas in that game.
Yes, so I haven't tried it yet. But yeah, he has a patch for 3D Blast that is apparently quite good that I need to try. And if you haven't, he has two YouTube channels. He has Game Hut and Coding Secrets, where he essentially just goes in to either games that he worked on and explains how they did things. And it's a lot of like 16-bit era stuff, or goes into games he didn't work on and explains how other developers did things, because he still has like old dev kits and stuff, and so he can like break down how all this works.
This might have to be a YouTube channel I start watching.
It's fast. He did a video on how he compressed the intro of I think it was Sonic 3D Blast, because it has like a pre-rendered intro on Genesis, and like how they compressed that down. And as like a video editor, I was like, this is the most fascinating thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, and I mean, that might be something I do on my Steam Deck, is play this director's cut of Sonic 3D Blast. Yeah,
look him up. His stuff is awesome.
And email us if there's any Genesis games on NSO that you want to highlight. Email us at connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. Always like to hear, like, give me your pitch for Zero Wing outside of the meme potential of it.
Honestly, I played some Zero Wing. Pretty decent shmup.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Like, I messed around with it a little bit, and I've heard, I mean, I'm not a shooter guy. I've realized that when, like, I thought about, like, should I get Radiant Silvergun? I love Treasure, and I'm I don't really like shooters that much. Like, Ikaruga's fine, but, like, it needs to be Sin and Punishment, not yes. Ship in 2D. Well,
the thing I appreciate about Zero Wing is that a lot of shmups have the problem of thinking they're arcade games, or literally being arcade games, and so they're quarter munchers, and so they're like kind of arguably impossible to play well. Whereas Zero Wing does a very good, like, it's not like there's challenge, but it's not, it doesn't have the like insane difficulty spikes that a lot of shmups do.
Yeah, like that's what, like, the bullet hell, which is kind of a dominant genre for that.
Yeah,
I do like the ones where it's like, just look at all this cool stuff, which, honestly, the Treasure game, like, I'm sure Radiant Silvergun probably does that, because Treasure was very good in all of their shooters of doing it, where it's just like, look at how cool this is. But it's not a genre for me. I've kind of just accepted that.
You know what else isn't a genre for you?
Ark.
Yeah, survival games with dinosaurs.
Although I do have a kid who's really into dinosaurs, so
more on that in a bit, because there's some of this actually applies to that. But for anyone who hasn't been paying attention, pretty early on in the Switch's lifespan, I don't remember when it was, maybe 2018, Ark Survival Evolved released on Switch. I reviewed it. I gave it a 2.5. It was horrible. Remains one of the worst Switch ports I've ever played in my entire life. Earlier this year, they announced that they were just doing it again. Like, not like fixing that version, but they had just brought in a new team. And they were going to port it to Switch again, and then release this entirely separate port as a patch that would just replace the previous version entirely. So, actually, earlier, like a couple hours ago, as on the day we're recording this, I got to sit down with a couple of the guys at Grove Street Games, who is the studio that's doing it. They are the people who did the mobile port of Ark, which makes sense. More infamously for Switch players, they're also the people who did the Grand Theft Auto games in the trilogy. But I don't believe, the more we learn about that, I don't think that was totally their fault. I think that was a Rockstar Games kind of problem. But they're doing this. Oh, and also, I guess the thing that I discovered while talking to them, they're also the guys that, most of you probably didn't even know this ever happened, but they're the guys that ported the first Conduit game to the NVIDIA Tegra. So they did a mobile port of the Conduit in HD, which was only available on like one device. And did not last on the store very long. So it's like very hard to find now. But yeah, so that's neat. I appreciate anyone who has ties to, you know, noted masterpiece The Conduit. But anyway, I got to sit down with them for a bit today and they showed me their new version of Ark. And wow, they went from a game that was outputting resolutions of, and I'm not kidding, 240p, which if you know your resolutions is a Nintendo 64 or half of a GameCube's resolution. They went from that to a game that is outputting, it's targeting 1080 docked 720 handheld. It's variable resolution, so it's not going to hit that. But the docked resolution at a glance looked to be 720 or above most of the time I was watching it. It looks really good. They actually pointed out that they had managed to get some features running in it that were not in like the Xbox One and PS4 versions of the game, just because essentially what they said is that they started with the Xbox One version. Because I initially thought, I was like, you guys did the mobile port. Did you start with that? And they're like, nope, we started with the Xbox One version and then used what we knew from the mobile port as far as optimization to like bring that back down. But they were talking about how, because it's Unreal Engine 4, they were able to make use of a bunch of like the optimizations and code that Epic themselves had figured out for Fortnite on Switch and apply that. And this, it looks like a different game. Like I'm going to put together a video. They sent me a bunch of footage and I'm going to put together a video that compares them, but it's pretty incredible that this can happen. And I asked them, you know, how, assuming the guys who did the original port, I'm sure they were decent programmers. Like what changed? Like what has allowed you to do this? And essentially they were just like, well, it's, you know, more experience with the platform, you know, years later, and then just updates to Unreal Engine that have happened over time, which I think is kind of an interesting thing to note, that like it's arguably not necessarily that like the original port of Ark was bad, but in context there's this idea that even though the system itself hasn't changed, the limitations haven't changed, the actual tools to put things onto that system have changed. And so you can port the same game twice and come out with very different results. And a lot of that can just be from how much the actual engine running the game has evolved on that system over the course of 4 years. Because they said they've only been working on this. This comes out in October, I believe, and they've only been working on it for a year. So extremely fast development time. And it looks great. I'll have more coverage of it. We should be getting a code for it before it comes out. But yeah, it looks very interesting. So if you are an Ark fan, and were extremely disappointed by the Switch version, I kind of laughed when they first announced it, but having seen it in person, like, yes, keep an eye on this. It looks incredible. And then to your point, Neil, they're working on, and they've announced this already, but I didn't get to see it, but they talked about it a little bit. They are creating a sort of like a separate release that's like a little spin-off thing that takes the worlds from Survival Evolved and like some of the dinosaurs that are based on real world dinosaurs and just makes a non-violent like exploration and educational game where you just find cool dinosaurs and like it tells you about the real world dinosaurs. So like that might actually be something that would appeal to you more so than normal Ark.
I mean, it's something that like as I actually found Parkasaurus, which was it was an indie world game. I reviewed it earlier in the year, and if you go read that review, I make mention of messing around with it with he was 3 at the time. Now he's 4. But Parkasaurus is really cute. I definitely did have to like kind of hold. I mean, because it's a Parkasaurus is like you're making it's a whatchamacallit, Roller Coaster Tycoon, but it's Jurassic Park. And I definitely had to hold his hand with that, but like especially the sandbox mode there was super fun to play in. Jurassic World Evolution, which was on Game Pass. There is the Switch version, which actually I think I did get the Switch version on sale. But like that is way intense. It seems like it's pretty good. Yes. But like that is not a game that I can play with my kid. And they also do the thing where I think you need to progress through the game in order to unlock the sandbox mode, which just kind of sucks. But like I'm on the lookout for, you know, cool dinosaur games. And I think especially if the you know, the promise of what the Switch version is, if they deliver on it and then they can do that kind of like educational exploratory mode, or it would be a separate release.
Yes, they said they're releasing it separately because actually this is pretty funny. They're releasing it separately because the base game is rated M.
Okay.
And they wanted kids to be able to boot it without triggering parental controls.
That makes a lot of sense.
And I was like, all right.
That does not seem money hungry. That just seems I mean, yeah. You can double dip in a way, but that just seems logical.
They are doing like a super duper version of Ark that comes with all the DLC and everything on Switch. Because so far Switch has not had any of the DLC.
Yeah, because it was just abysmal.
Yes. And they said that like they're not only adding that DLC over the course of the next year, they're also rerunning like live service events that were on the other versions that Switch was never able to have.
Oh, that's awesome.
So they're like going through the game's lifespan again so that you can get all of like the exclusive skins and all that. It's really like the amount of like effort and thought that's going into this is kind of crazy. But I was going to say, I don't remember what it's called, but the, you know, educational side game, if that's included in that complete thing, which it might be, or if it's totally separate. Yeah. I believe it's
definitely gonna be on my radar. That sounds like something perfect for my boy.
Yeah. The other thing that I've been playing a little bit, I just started today, is 13.
It was a game so bad they never even brought it to Switch. The Switch version just got canceled.
There's a weird theme here.
Yeah. I played this game. So 13 is based off of, I want to say like it's a French or a Canadian comic book. But there was a GameCube era release, 13, mm-hmm. first person shooter, cel shaded style. I think David Duchovny voiced the main character.
Does he?
Or at least I think he did. I don't know if
it's I haven't thought about it. I think I heard Adam West at one point in it, but I don't know if that's true. I just heard one character talk and I'm like, that's definitely Batman.
Yeah, let's see. Do they have David Duchovny voice the protagonist? I don't know if he still does in the remake.
I'm gonna have to listen more closely. I'm sure it is the voice. I mean, I'm pretty sure all the voice acting is the same. It has a certain compression that leads me to believe it is probably the old voice acting.
But yeah. Oh, Belgian graphic novel series called 13. Okay. But it's presented in a cool cel shaded presentation, and it was a game that I wound up. I think it was. Like somebody that I knew had a copy of it and was like, this is actually like a super fun multiplayer game.
Yeah.
So I played a ton of this in local split screen because it was that era when like, I mean, I did not personally own an Xbox. Like, you know, I played a bunch of Halo as any, you know, 13-year-old in 2001 did. But on GameCube, like it was basically like Time Splitters 2 and then like what else was there? So 13 kind of scratched an itch for a while where like it was super fun, you know, GoldenEye successor kind of multiplayer stuff, made by Ubisoft Paris back in the day. But the one thing that always like it does the thing where it has the onomatopoeia show up at the screen. And when you fire off like a rocket launcher or something, it looks like it says Bayoum. I think it's supposed to say boom, but like, I just thought that was something that like, I just remember playing this multiplayer with friends. And someone getting the Bayoum and then running around and shouting Bayoum as they would shoot people. But I was curious about this remake because I have a lot of fond memories with this game. And then it came out, I think initially when did it come out? 2020. But it didn't. The Switch release was delayed, and the release on PS4, Xbox One, and PC was hilariously terrible. So much so that they essentially did the same thing as Ark, where they rebooted it from the ground up. And from what I've heard so far, I think it's fine. How are you enjoying the Switch version?
I like it. I'm actually looking at some footage of the previous remaster, like the 2020 version. And I didn't realize that, like, that in a lot of ways, the 2020 version kind of, like, pulled out most of the cel shading. Like, yeah, your hands are kind of cel shaded, but like the world doesn't really look cel shaded at all.
Yeah, I remember that critique. Because I did not play the remake because I just heard from everybody that like, oh, they messed it up. Like I want to say like John from Digital Foundry like had some tweet being like it's no good, and then I was like, yep, okay, I can filter that away as no.
Yeah, just from looking at this, because I do not have experience with the GameCube version. I just like first person shooters. But looking at that comparison, yeah, this version of the remake looks way more in line with the GameCube version visually. I do have some critiques in that one of them is more just funny. That I'm assuming, once again, having not played the GameCube version, it begins with like a pre-rendered cutscene. And so in the GameCube version, I'm assuming this pre-rendered cutscene just plays full screen. In this version, because they decided not to redo that pre-rendered cutscene, and so you have like GameCube era character models, they decided that the best way to do this would be to have the character model from this version of the game like walk into an FBI conference room and watch the intro playing on a TV. To, I guess, sort of like make it a little less obvious that these aren't the same graphics. But the problem is that it makes it way more obvious because I can see that like the new version of the character watching blocky ass GameCube version of the character. And yeah. I feel like, A, you redid every other cutscene, some of which I believe are pre-rendered, but you didn't redo that one, which is weird. And then honestly, if you had just played that full screen, it would have been less obvious to me than if you give me a point of comparison while it's playing.
Yeah.
But the other weird visual thing is that the Switch version of this targets 30 frames per second, expected, though I wouldn't be surprised if this were like, I don't know, does the GameCube version run at 60? Because a lot of GameCube games did.
It might have. I do think, I would imagine probably the base, it was a multi-platform release. It's just GameCube.
Yes, I'm sure the Xbox and PS4 versions run at 60. But they're occasionally like between levels, some of the cutscenes are pre-rendered, which they're very well pre-rendered. Like there's no compression artifacts on them. Like it took me a second to realize they were pre-rendered. But the giveaway is that all of those cutscenes play at 60 frames per second, which is kind of a, like if you had just chopped those pre-rendered cutscenes down to 30 frames per second so that they match the gameplay, I honestly might not have noticed they were pre-rendered. But then you left them at 60, probably rendered directly off one of the other systems, and it's like painfully obvious. The game itself, image quality is fantastic. It is so stinking sharp. Maybe a little too sharp, because the frame rate is not so fantastic. It does okay when you're in kind of like interior levels, like going through buildings, but like the level I just finished, you were like outside on like some rooftops trying to escape from bad guys. And anytime you kind of like looked out across the city, it just chugged. So honestly, I feel like they could probably have gone down a little ways on the resolution and got away with it. Cause like right now it might be dynamic, but it feels close to a full 1080 docked. And usually a full 720 handheld, like, in a still image of this looks amazing. It just has some trouble in motion. And so I feel like could probably get away with going a little lower if that would help the frame rate. Obviously, I don't know where the bottleneck is, but you know, but yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. It definitely has some of those like early shooter isms. Like when Halo came out, the reason that Halo was such a big deal is because it kind of revolutionized how first person shooters played. And there was an era kind of like before that, even kind of overlapping with it, where shooters were a lot slower and more methodical, had more like kind of puzzle solving. Yeah,
I mean, it's that GoldenEye to Halo yeah. line of the consoleization of shooters, so to speak.
Yes. And this definitely, I could not know that this was a remake and tell you exactly what era it was from. Like. Like, I could get pretty darn close to the year.
What do you think the year is?
I would say 2004.
Three.
Oh, see? All right,
late 2003, though. So.
Okay, yeah, I could tell it was late. Yeah, I could feel, you know, the Christmas season approaching. But yeah, so it definitely feels like it's of that era, but it plays well outside of the frame rate stuff. And yeah, and looking at seeing how the remaster previously looked, yeah, this is at least on a visual front. I don't know how the original remaster played. And I'm going to try out the GameCube version just for comparison.
I might have a copy of it, but I'm not sure if I it's one of those games where I don't know if I ever actually had my own copy or if I just borrowed it from somebody.
Yeah, worst case scenario, I will waking dream it onto the Xbox and play it.
I mean, it might not be that expensive a GameCube game, but it's also probably not a GameCube game worth
getting. I think it might be. I don't know that there is such a thing as not that expensive of a GameCube game at this point.
Yeah,
like it's kind of everything.
Price charting 13. Yep, I mean, it's definitely this hilariously risen in price. It is. In 2014, it was $6 complete in box, and now it is $25.
That's still not that bad.
Yeah, it's around $20 for a. You could probably find a complete in box copy for $20.
Okay, yeah, I might keep an eye out for it, but otherwise, I'll throw it on the Xbox and try it on there. I just want to get a base of comparison for how it actually plays, compared to the GameCube one. But yeah, I'm having a good time. I can definitely say it does seem to be an improvement over the last version of the remake. So that's something.
Cool.
Well, with that, I think that's about all we have for this episode. Once again, write in with any Genesis games you'd recommend. Maybe write in if you have any Genesis games you'd like to see added to NSO. And here's a random assignment. Write in with a Switch game that you wish they would just port to Switch again and give it a second go.
Hyrule Warriors Age of Calamity.
Honestly, Hyrule Warriors Definitive Edition.
Yeah, actually, I mean,
that's maybe port the port. Wii U version this time and not the 3DS version, you psychos. But yeah, that's all we got. The email address for that is connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. If you're listening to this somewhere where you can leave a review, that'd be a super nice thing you could do, and we'd appreciate it, especially if it was a positive one. You can follow us on Twitter @ConnectivityNWR, and we will see you next time. This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.
I mean, they could remake Breath of the Wild, but they're already doing that next year anyway, so we don't need to ask them to do it.
I did get a comment on our TikTok, on one of our TikToks about Tears of the Kingdom, asking if Tears of the Kingdom was a new game or a DLC.
The next 9 months are going to be fun, aren't they?
It'll be good.
Because that map, guess what? That map is probably gonna be the original Hyrule.
There's gonna be
and to the naked eye you're gonna look at it and be like, this is just the same thing, but it's probably wholly different.
Yep.
All right. Yep. Bye.
Bye.